Hi, everybody, and welcome to this very special episode of the Kamideh Podcast. I'm your host, Subi Sadeh. On this episode, I was joined by Syed Badrawi, who is a pharma, medtech investor, and board member. In this episode, Syed talks about his experience starting at Amgen when it was only about 100 people. He talks about transitioning from being a bench scientist to the business commercial side of pharma. He talks about what he recommends in terms of people's approaches to their career working in startups versus large companies. And he also talks about silos in our industry and their impact on commercialization. I hope you enjoy this episode with Syed. Please subscribe on whatever platform you're listening on. And here is Syed.
Hello, Combi Nation. My name is Subi Sadeh. I've spent over a decade in medical device, pharma, and combination product development. Our industry feels complicated sometimes. Drugs, devices, clinical trials, submissions, sterilization, validation, design control, risk management, market access, reimbursement. The list goes on. My goal is mastery. So this podcast is to ask questions I have to people who may have the answers. Each week on the Kamideh Podcast, I talk to someone about their area to further understand and simplify. Whether you're a pharma person trying to understand the next wave of products, or a device person trying to navigate a pharma system you're unfamiliar with, or a newbie in both areas, I invite you to listen, and together we can simplify by combinating.
My interest in life sciences started from when I was a kid. I used to love microscopes, and I used to love looking at all those little creatures in the water drops and things like that. And I got a life science degree when I was in college. And at that time, biotech was the hot thing, and people were talking about it, Genentech, things like that. I started to work in a research lab at the university, and then leveraged that into a job and as a bench scientist at a little tiny startup at the time called Amgen, and spent 3 years there. It was quite exciting times. And then went back to business school to learn the other side of the pharma industry, and proceeded to work for a couple of large pharmas, and then got involved with multiple startups and did some very interesting things that were pharmaceutical, diagnostics, and even digital health. So I've got this interesting wide bandwidth, and I try and use my experiences in the different areas to apply them to other areas, because that's the definition of being creative, I think.
And so you've landed in the sweet spot of commercialization.
Yes, I landed in that area because I felt it was a very good way to leverage my scientific background and at the same time really look to understand how all of that is applied to the end customer being the patient. I was always very proud of the fact that what everything we do, we're not making sugared water or Coca-Cola or whatever. We're really trying to help people, and our decisions can either save someone or can kill them if we make bad decisions. So I felt that was a great way to live a professional life.
To be clear, when you say commercialization, what does it mean in your vernacular?
That's a great question. I think the way you can look at that, obviously within healthcare, it's so varied, but to use pharmaceuticals as an example, commercialization really relates to once you have a compound and you recognize that it has a potential in a particular therapeutic area, the hard, cold reality of capitalism is somehow you have to be sure that drug meets the need in a way that you can achieve a profit and that it's a viable product. And all of that is under what I call a risk umbrella. You have to determine the risks involved in bringing the product to market. And what's really important is what are the clinical studies that you need to do to provide the safety and the efficacy data that to a physician and secondarily to an insurance company makes the product a viable product. And the medical device side, it's a similar situation as well. You still have to have the safety and the efficacy. The process is just a little bit different, but the fundamentals, in my opinion, very similar. Oddly enough, in our industry, there's a lot of siloing between device and pharma, which I never fully understood, but it is what it is.
Yeah. But my audience is primarily in that in between where the drug and the device is combined, right? And the reason that I ask about the definition of commercialization is because from a product development point of view, a lot of times people tie commercialization, when they hear that, they think commercialization engineering. So they're thinking scale up and control plan. And when you're in a technical arena and you're not considering a lot of the market accessy considerations that you were talking about with the safety efficacy studies. Now, here you're not talking about safety efficacy studies that are expected for regulatory submission and proving safety efficacy to just the regulators. You're talking about real world evidence, stuff that would help the physicians and end users understand, or the physicians primarily, the prescribers understand what is the kind of cost benefit or what is the benefit to the product.
Well, it's a continuum, really. And the FDA is quite smart about that. The reality is you're going to have very specific claims in your packaging that you want. And again, I'm talking about, these are NDA type products. We're not talking generics in this situation. So those claims are fundamental to how the product will be positioned in the market. And having that information structured in such a way that is believable is very important. The whole clinical trial process is becoming more and more challenging, in my opinion, because there's less low-hanging fruit. And you can't just say our product meets the needs for this particular disease state if there are other products on the market that do similar things. So you also have to take into account everything else in the market, and you have to make sure that you have a story to tell why this product or your product is superior to those other products. And that can be challenging.
Because I think you're maybe more involved in the pipeline planning, what's it, like product roadmap-y discussions, to use like a tech term. I always think about that. There's, to me, there's like this dichotomy in my head. It's for the people that are seeking opportunity, just more and more opportunities will come up where it's just, there's opportunity everywhere. But to some who will see this giant disease has been dealt with, and that giant disease has been dealt with, and that giant disease has been dealt with, is it actually true that there's less opportunity now? Or what is that like?
All you have to do is look at the pipelines that get published about what's going on, and meetings like JP Morgan, et cetera. When was the last time you saw excitement from small molecules? Everything has moved now to antibodies or immune system or very complicated proteins, things like that. It doesn't mean that they don't exist and there aren't opportunities. It's just become more difficult. The other thing that used to happen that I'm not sure it happens as much today, but maybe 10, 15 years ago, a lot of pharma companies took this approach. They wanted to have a franchise. So they wanted a diabetes franchise. They wanted an oncology franchise, et cetera. And I think what's happening is companies realize it's so difficult to bring a product to market that you don't have that luxury anymore of saying, oh, I just want to look at products that fit within a certain disease area. It's become more, gee, if I can do something and find something that works, I will build the commercial operation to market that product, whatever that disease state is. Okay.
And so go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and so you're saying that the idea that company A is a hemophilia company and company B is a diabetes company and company C is a gastro company, you're saying that's going to become less and less prevalent, you think?
That's my observation or belief. It's just because, again, it's so expensive to develop a drug. That's one thing. I don't know how much your listeners should know this because it's very important. And that is, when you look at the success rate of pharmaceuticals from the type that from the minute they've lead generation, compounds identified, validation, et cetera, the preclinical work, by the time they get it to phase one clinical study, still the probability of success of the clinical studies is like 1 out of 10. It's very low.
You're saying the probability is low late stage.
Late stage. Yes, it's very low. In fact, my opinion is from my experience in preclinical research is that one of the big problems is that we don't have really good models to predict toxicology, safety issues when we have a new compound that we bring to market. The animals can only give you so much information to predict what will happen in humans. And there was a big hope that we would be able to take all this big data, combined data sets, et cetera, and start to get more insight into a compound and the probability of seeing a safety issue in men, that we hope that would have become more predictive. We're not there yet, but the FDA, for instance, that's why all filings now with the FDA in terms of an IND or an NDA have to be in a very specific format. It's all been put into these categories and very specific descriptors so that the data can be combined at the macro level and do data mining, looking for patterns.
Your
translational medicine is what it is, basically.
But you strike me as more of like a business guy. And so the stuff that you're talking about, INDs and TPPs and stuff, is not really in the wheelhouse of the business folks.
So if you're in a bigger pharmaceutical company, just by definition, most of the people within that organization are going to be more specialized, right? So you have departments, various departments that handle the various areas. But that's actually been a big problem with pharmaceutical companies, is the so-called siloing. Right? And that causes a lot of friction and slows things down. As opposed to, and my more recent experience was with smaller companies where we have to wear multiple hats and we do everything. As a CEO, you're going to sit in a meeting on toxicology findings of animal studies. You need to see that. So it really depends on the size of the organization in terms of those things.
The exposure. Interesting.
Yes.
What have you seen in terms of, have you seen any huge successes?
Oh, when you look at what's made the press, for instance, obviously we had CAR T therapies. Everyone was very excited about those. And that's a classic example of, that's not a drug. What is that? It's a little bit of DNA manipulation, genetic engineering. It's a bit of process. It's cell culturing. It's multiple things. And what fascinated me was you saw so much hype about these products, potential. And yet what we see happening is the reality that the pricing structure is just palatable. Having a course of therapy for a person over $1 million to save a life, is it worth it? Of course it is. But can society afford it? And companies like Bluebird Bio, and there's companies where they've decided not to launch a product in certain countries, things like that. It's been a very interesting thing to watch. another, so it's not really a success story in that it's technically successful, but in terms of commercialization and bringing it to market, it's been difficult. Another success story, obviously, is that Wegovy, all these new drugs for diabetes, the GLP-1 drugs, these drugs have really revolutionized weight loss treatment. But I have, again, if you look at the weight loss market, it's like full of previous attempts that ended up crashing and burning for various reasons. And I think this class of drugs is going to be successful, but it's creating huge pressures on the societies because they're originally designed for diabetic patients or morbidly obese people that literally are suffering from obesity that they can't control otherwise. I don't think there's a question about how those drugs will proceed in those markets. The problem is people in LA who want to drop 20 pounds, okay, and they want to take that drug, who's going to pay for it? And already I saw that there's a spike in overdoses from those drugs. Because
what does that mean?
I'm not really sure. I just saw the headlines, but apparently I believe these are injectables, self-injectables.
Yeah, so they are.
Probably someone is saying, gee, it's bikini season. I only lost 5 pounds. So if I take more of this stuff, I'll lose more weight. And by the way, that is how people think, okay? We tend to forget we're a relatively educated group here. We work in the industry, and I see this all the time. People forget when you're dealing with the mean or median of society, you really have to understand that people don't have the back. Look at the big debates with the COVID vaccines. This is same thing, same issue.
I've had any failures?
Yeah.
Can you tell me about some of the failures?
In general, less failure from commercialization where the drug just doesn't seem to be exciting enough. You see that. But what happens is that there's an argument that even if your drug is a me too product, the reality is when you look at patient populations, there's always going to be a large enough population that for whatever reason has a negative reaction to that drug or that drug doesn't work. So the physician likes to have an armamentarium, so to speak, of different drugs for the same treatment. So if one doesn't work or causes a certain patient a side effect, they have another one. But still, it can be a commercial failure in that it's just not particularly effective. And the other thing I've seen happen with those kind of drugs sometimes, and there's some famous cases, which I don't know if I can recall exactly where, a drug was floundering and not doing well in the market, and they simply jacked the price up. Okay. And this is, remember what's his name? Scarelli?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. The drug was the little niche product and they jacked the price up. So that's another example.
But he took it like to a crazy level.
He did take it to a crazy level. Absolutely. Yeah. And only. You'd never see a large pharma company do that. That's more of these fly-by-night smaller operations. But in general, most of the time, the failure comes from post-marketing information. Despite everything we do with a phase 3 data, with a phase 3 clinical study, and all of the analysis to look for safety signals, the reality is if a clinical study has a few hundred sometimes, depending on the therapeutic class or disease, or thousands of people. Once it's in the wider open market, sometimes you start to see a signal. And that signal can be dangerous, especially if there's an alternative product in the market, and that can cause the product to fail. When I was at Abbott Labs, we had a drug. It was an antibiotic. I think it was at that time called fluoroquine class of drugs, and it was a great product, but it had to be pulled off the market famous example is Vioxx, which was an excellent painkiller and was pulled from the market. And to this day, if you talk to people, there's many people that feel if the patient population was better defined, in other words, if you didn't have certain comorbidities, et cetera, it still would have been a great drug because the people that used it really liked the drug.
Interesting. I've heard about Vioxx before, but I hadn't really looked into it a whole lot. I think it was a Merck drug.
Yes.
Switching gears. So I know that you spent a lot of time, obviously, what made you decide actually to go from being a bench chemist to focusing more on the business side? Because you went from microbiology, UC Berkeley, micro,
yeah,
and then you went Booth MBA.
Yeah. I enjoyed the science and I was basically doing prokaryotic molecular biology. So I was working with different types of bacteria and transfecting them with viruses, microphage to basically genetic, good old classic genetic engineering. But I realized for my career to grow, I would have to go back to school and get a PhD. And
on the science side.
On the science side, yes. Either that or I would have to branch off into protein purification, regulatory, things like that. But in that situation, you still need to have an organization that's mature enough that they can train you. And at the time, Amgen was a very young company. I just didn't have the gumption to spend another 4 years in school. And remember, I worked in a research lab, so I saw the culture and the push. You know, you always have to publish and you're always scrambling for money and the politics. And I just didn't want to deal with that. Plus, my dad had been an engineer and he had gotten his master's in business and many of his friends, and they got involved in these very cool companies and stuff like that. And I said, leveraging their technical background. So I said, you know what? I'll do the same on the life science side. And in that situation, I feel like I was quite prophetic in that I had seen that coming and that worked out well. Getting the business degree, again, once I got that degree, what do I do with it? And many doors got opened up. That was the other thing is, once you get the degree, you get your butt stamped. So after getting my business degree, I had a lot of opportunities either to go into consulting or go back to work in the pharma industry. And I chose, I wanted to go back into the industry, again, leveraging the science and looking at bringing new products to market, because that excites me. I just like to be around things where I feel like making a difference in the world. And what could be make a bigger, more honorable difference than bringing a new drug or device to market? It's a no-brainer to me. So that's what I did. And I ended up working for large pharma companies. I worked for Eli Lilly, Abbott Labs. I had great experiences and then made a
switch. It's crazy, by the way, that you're talking about Amgen like it's not a large pharma company, because it wasn't. But
yeah. When I joined the company, it was like about 100 employees. And let me tell you something. Don't let anyone ever tell you that luck is not involved. When I got there, basically, we were feverishly working on everything from artificial indigo that would be produced by bacteria in fermentation. We were looking at interferons and shooting them up cows. I don't even remember why. We were looking at all kinds of things, whatever would stick, right? And erythropoietin, which was like the first or second real big blockbuster in terms of a genetically engineered drug. And I just, by luck, I happened to be put on that team. I was part of the team that first cloned and expressed that gene. And the original plan, even for that drug, was to be produced in bacteria. In Chicago, by the way. In fact, Amgen had bought a plant and was building a plant to produce this drug. And come to find out that proteins produced by bacteria have a very different so-called methylation, number one, and glycosylation. What that means is if you take EPO made from bacteria, highly purified and injected in a mammal or a human, its half-life is very short because it's very quickly identified as something foreign and it's eliminated. If you use something like so-called CHO, Chinese hamster ovary cells, to produce the compound, it has a glycosylation or sugar branches. It doesn't have a methyl group at the end. It's very similar to human EPO. And so when you inject it in man, it had a much better half-life. And it was the only way to go. So you can imagine all the challenges that happened along the way to get this product. It was fascinating. It's fascinating.
And the luck?
And well, the luck is you found a solution. The luck is that EPO worked. Okay. Indigo didn't work so well. The interferons didn't work well. So you have to remember that the first time I heard about a monoclonal antibody was in 1975. As a teenager, I went to a presentation at Stanford University. 1975. Monoclonal antibodies have been around that long. Look, it took decades before we were able to really understand them and harness them. And there's always luck involved in that process.
As far as learning the business as a technical person, so you decided to make a switch. How would you recommend that somebody who is not trying to make a switch approach that? People who say don't want to get an MBA.
I think it depends on the organization, but if you have a technical background, but you want that exposure, you probably need to get involved or move towards things like, it could be as simple as project management, okay? Roles where there's a business input into the decision-making process, all right? Regulatory affairs is the area. And it really depends on the size of the organization as well. If you work for a larger organization, by design, there's parallel tracks in terms of you can have a very successful and profitable career staying in regulatory your whole career or in manufacturing, etc. And just by definition, almost, if you're moving up the corporate ladder, you reach a point where you're going to get exposure to the business side. Because
no matter what,
exactly. And ultimately, it all boils down to budgets, okay? And where do the budgets come from and what defines a budget? And so you're going to want to understand that and the organization needs to explain to you, we have defined these areas we're emphasizing and you ask why, and it's because the business set tells us X, Y, and Z and things like that. Social media has completely changed the ball game about how we get our information. And it's, on the one hand, empowered people to very rapidly get information. But the downside is it's discounting the need for expertise. It's discounting the need to have a technical background if you're looking at something. Any kind of background. You need context. You need to really have the history of something or the science behind something. And so I have a sort of a mixed feelings coming back to our industry for a minute here, because you really touched on a very important point. And that is, and I tell young people that are starting out in this industry, and I hired a lot of young people, you need to become an expert in a certain area of healthcare. If you're in, say, pharma or device, whether it's the science, regulatory, manufacturing, you need to do that, understand that, do it for X number of years. And only after that point should you be thinking about more career-related moves in terms of joining a smaller company from a big one, vice versa, etc. Because if you don't do that, our industry is very highly regulated. And you always have to have that to fall back on, that you really do understand a certain aspect of business.
Where you're the ex
person. Where you're the expert on it. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I have seen people that, say, for instance, started at very small companies, never had that expertise and jumped around and did a little of this or that, primarily because they were the only human body to handle that area. And it's generally a disaster. Okay. It's not. That's why startups can fail in that situation.
And so you don't, it doesn't sound like you recommend that early in their career people start in.
I don't. I think if you want to really become valuable, you go to a bigger pharma company, you get your experience, you learn how to do it. Remember, it's like building cars. People just don't build them out of the blue. It's an iterative process that's taken decades to learn how to do. It's the same thing with drug and device development. Okay. It's very complicated. It's confusing. It's not marketing, easy marketing, because the commercial and regulatory issues. You learn that at a larger company. You've picked up all the basics. Then you can come to a smaller company and you'll have that basis that the smaller company, the staff will find you much more valuable because you already know how to do something and do it. So that's my recommendation. And the thing I always tell people is, remember, when you go to a small company, what you're really talking about is risk. Okay. A larger company, less risk from your personal career level in terms of being laid off. When you go to a smaller company, many of them have one compound, two compounds. Okay. They're high risk. And the question you have to ask yourself, am I getting properly compensated for the risk I'm taking? And most people don't think about that. Okay. They just think, oh, it's a smaller company. Yeah. They got these cool drugs. They're getting all this press. But if you really understand what they're doing, the statistical odds of success are very small. That's why if they go public, or if they're bought out, it's at a high multiple. And I tell people, if you go to a small company, you need some kind of long-term incentive, like stock options, etc. They can be complicated. If you don't understand it, find someone who does. Because I've seen so many small companies that whether they're successful or they fail, the C-suite, the CEO, CFO, etc., they do okay no matter what. And then the rest of the employees are just left holding the bag. You don't want to be one of those employees.
Where can people find you, Sayed?
Where can people find me? I'm on LinkedIn. And that's my primary exposure. And I am always happy to, if anyone would like to connect, they simply can just shoot me a message. More than happy to talk to them. I'm at a point in my career where I try to pay it forward and try and help people, younger people trying to be successful in this industry. It brings me a lot of satisfaction. So.
Well, very good. Thanks for coming on, Sayed. This was awesome.
Shubi, is actually wonderful to be here. I'm very honored. Thank you very much. And best of luck to you.
Thank you.